Susan Burton was locked up 6 different times, and after a long road to recovery, she spent the last 2 decades helping other incarcerated women re-enter society after they're released. Here she is on Fresh Air.
You're giving back this opportunity to make decisions for yourself. You try your best, but the insurmountable obstacles that you face are just really difficult to overcome without support.
She joins us in studio, along with NPR's Sam Sanders. Here he is in a fiery debate with comedian Jimmy Yang on his show, It's Been a Minute.
I can tell you each one of the sauces without looking at it.
Okay, go.
It's a green guacamole one.
Okay.
That one's by far my favorite.
Why?
Because it's watery, it's a little...
I don't believe in watery guacamole, bro.
But, exactly. But it's a salsa, so it's okay. They don't try to sell you as guacamole. It's all about how you look at it. It's okay.
That's a good rule for life, huh?
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The United States has more than 2.2 million people behind bars. That's according to the latest government data, more than any country and more than any other country in the world. And since 1980, the incarceration rate for women has increased 700%. Most of these women are imprisoned for nonviolent offenses, and when they're released, the challenge is staying out. If you recall from earlier this week when we talked about the Kewanee Life Skills Reentry Center, Illinois' recidivism rate is at about 45%. But among the women one California nonprofit works with, in 2015, 96% of those women stayed out of prison. That's a 4% recidivism rate. The nonprofit is called A New Way of Life, and they say they've been able to help these California women with successful reentry at about half the cost it took for incarceration. Susan Burton is the founder of A New Way of Life. She's also the author of Becoming Ms. Burton, which chronicles her extraordinary life story from incarceration to creating this nonprofit. I should note for our audience, her story includes sexual abuse, so this conversation may not be appropriate for all of our listeners. Ms. Burton is here in Illinois because she's been visiting with U of I's Education Justice Project, and she's in our studios at Urbana. Ms. Burton, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
I say extraordinary because I think many people, upon hearing the details of your life, would indeed say that you have had such an extraordinary life and you've endured so much. And you talk about this in your book that just came out last year, your years of sexual abuse that started when you were 4. You gave birth to your first child at 14, and that was after you were raped. I can't imagine how hard it was for you to write the story of your childhood and share these stories publicly. What motivated you to write this book?
I believe that the story of who the women are that are incarcerated, it needed to be told. When we talk about mass incarceration and those 2.3 million people, we hardly ever think about the women. And this story, I felt, would raise a conversation around the women that we're incarcerating. And while I put my story out there front and center, I received so much communication from women saying, when I read your book, I read my story. So over 70% of women incarcerated have experienced sexual abuse, domestic violence, molestation as a child. So although I tell the story through the lens of my life, we're talking about the thousands and the hundreds of thousands of women across this country also that are incarcerated.
And to that point, to your story, one of the things that really struck me was that as you had decades of this abuse that happened to you that started when you were very young and continued throughout your preteen and teen years, no one ever said to you until decades later that this wasn't your fault.
Yeah. Actually, 4 decades later, I was able to access therapy. And through the therapy sessions, I began to understand that it was not my fault. And the because earlier on, I talk in the book about my auntie blaming me and calling me names when she discovered what her boyfriend was doing to me. And I took that in and I wore it and I bared the burden of being abused, wearing it as if it was my fault. So, yeah, years later, I accessed resources that should have been and could have been available to me much earlier. There were so many times that there was space for something or someone to intercede to help me navigate what was happening in my life. But nothing intercede until my response to the trauma was criminalized. And that's what I see all across America. The response to poor women's trauma becoming criminalized when they use drugs to medicate it or alcohol to medicate it. And as I was in a prison here yesterday, and as I was talking about how we navigate trauma in our lives, there was a lot of head nods going on in the audience. So, you know, I know that what I'm saying is the experience of other women.
My guest is Susan Burton. She's the founder of A New Way of Life, the nonprofit that we are going to be talking about in a minute that she started. She's also the author of Becoming Ms. Burton. If you have questions or comments, you're always welcome to give us a call. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. You can also tweet your questions to 21STShow. That's our handle. So, Ms. Burton, you were in and out of jail six different times. What do you think finally made the difference for you not to go back in?
What finally made the difference for me not to go back to prison is that I received help. I received help in a upscale community on the beach in Santa Monica, where I was able to deal with the trauma of the past. I joined AA's 12-step program, and I began to heal and get better. But the deal breaker for me was receiving community supports and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. That was the difference, and that's also what propelled me to look at my community and the needs of the community and create A New Way of Life Reentry Project. And, you know, A New Way of Life to date has helped over 1,000 women come back into the community, helped women, 300 women to reunite with their children. So.
And I wanted to ask you about some of those stories of, as you said in the book, not just your story, but many of the women that you talk about. And I wanted, there's a woman that you start the book with, and it's her name is Ingrid.
Yes.
And she received a 3-year prison sentence for leaving her sleeping baby in a car. Can you tell us that story?
Yeah. So Ingrid took her toddler on her hip with her into the store and left her newborn in the car seat in the car while she ran into a General Dollar store and bought Pampers and baby formula. She wasn't gone any more than 10 minutes, maybe 8 minutes, and she returned to the car and the police was there. And she was arrested for child endangerment, even though the baby was unharmed, and she was sentenced to 3 years in prison. And my thought around that is that, you know, had Ingrid had been a person of means, had Ingrid been in a different neighborhood, had Ingrid not been black, would she have been given 3 years in prison, or would she have been sent to therapy classes, parenting classes, and given supports to be to understand the mistake that she made? And I see this over and over again. One of the other things that I compared was when I was in Santa Monica at this pretty exclusive recovery place, I saw that people in Santa Monica weren't punished, weren't criminalized, and weren't caged and chained for drug use. They were given help. And I'm like, why is there such a different approach in poor communities across America? My community was South L.A. And so I see that as part of the unjust system that we have here in this nation, that people of means get other treatment from poor people. So our prisons are filled with poor people across America.
And you also, to that point, you share a story of another woman named Lisa James, and the $40,000 in debt that she accumulated while she was in prison because she had to pay child support back when she came out of prison because she was separated from her children. How common are debts like that for mothers who go into prison?
They're common for mothers. They're common for fathers, and they're common for mothers. So you are pretty much a prisoner or a ward of the state. And you're expected to be able to pay child support while you're a ward of the state. And these debts just pile up and pile up and pile up. So when a person is released, not only do they have these 48,000 barriers that's been documented by the American Bar Association, they also have this big weight of a debt. So if they are able to get a job, Their paychecks are confiscated. And I need to tell you that while people are incarcerated, they make like 10 cents an hour, 8 cents an hour. A high-paying job inside of a institution is $1 an hour. That's the executive-level pay. And how do you pay child support with those types of wages? So it's a really a system. Our criminal justice system is a system that we really need to look closely and dismantle much of what it has done and is doing to people.
My guest is Susan Burton. We're talking about her story and the women that she has worked with in reentry through A New Way of Life. If you've got questions or comments for us, you can always tweet us at 21STShow. Our phone number is also 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. Ms. Burton, I wonder if you can share a little bit about A New Way of Life. And you just talked about so many obstacles that are in place for and let's just talk about women, because I think we oftentimes, I think when we have this conversation, we talk about men who are returning citizens as opposed to women.
Yes.
Can you give us an example of some of the specific challenges and the ways that you have approached this with A New Way of Life with the women that you're helping in California?
Yeah. So A New Way of Life consists of five single family homes throughout the community of South L.A. And it's a place that women can be released to or come to after they spend some time incarcerated. A place there where they can feel welcomed, valuable, and a part of the community. While we have structure there, we also have a lot of resources from job. We have a job developer there on site. We have financial classes. We have an attorney to help women get their children back. It's two women to each bedroom. The morning starts with morning meditation and goal setting, and there's a 10 o'clock curfew. We engage in community events. We engage in political events, and we engage in 12-step meetings. And it's a place where people can land, not feel judged, feel welcomed, and have the opportunity to rebuild their lives, whatever that might be, whether it's going to get a job, going to school, or going to drug treatment, or whatever their dreams or needs may be.
What kind of emotional support do you think is most important for people who have been incarcerated?
It depends on the individual. And we take an individualized approach. We also have a therapist on staff that each woman can get a schedule with the therapist, whether it's once a week, once a month, every 2 weeks, whatever her need and schedule is. I think the freedom to be able to access what you need, and you being the person who recognizes and realizes that and goes after it, is just real important for any and all of our development.
And do you think, how important is it also to have mothers reunited with their children? What kind of difference do you think that makes in terms of recidivism?
I mean, it's really important. Children ache for their mother, and mothers ache to be responsible and good parents for their children. So we have child reunification services on site. We actually have an attorney to help our residents walk through the process of reuniting with children. And children can be a grounder, or are a grounder for women to stay crime free, to be good parents, to provide for their children, and look to create a home after some time at a new way of life. So it's really, really important. As you know, my 5-year-old son was killed by an LAPD detective, and that sent me just reeling into alcoholism and addiction, which got me incarcerated. So I know how important it is to have your child, to be able to parent your child. So, yeah.
I'm so sorry for your loss. Thank you for sharing that with us. I want to pick up this conversation. We have to take a break, but when we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Susan Burton about her story and these women, and a conversation about incarceration in America. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning into The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. My guest is Susan Burton. She's a former Soros Fellow. She's the author of Becoming Ms. Burton, which chronicles her life story. She's also the founder of A New Way of Life. And we're talking about her work with women who have been incarcerated. She's here in Illinois because she's been visiting with U of I's Education Justice Project. And Ms. Burton, I wanted to ask you, your work started in California, but you're working across the country and you're here in Illinois, where we have the largest jail in the country. That's Cook County, which, by the way, Cook County Sheriff Tom Dart has described as the country's also largest mental health facility. What do you think of how our prison system in Illinois works? How do you think it compares to other states?
So I think this country, Chicago, Illinois is included, has a real problem to its approach to creating safe and thriving communities. There is sort of like the, what do we have here, the disease of incarceration. So many individuals. Last month, I was at Cook County Jail, and I went in and did a book reading with the women there. And I went yesterday with Rebecca Ginsburg to Decatur, I think it was.
The Decatur Women's Prison.
The Decatur mm-hmm. Women's Prison, and sat down and did a book reading with those women also. I think that we could really shift resources in a way to create what really makes communities safe, and that would be really good schools. That would be parks, arts, recreation for our communities. That would be housing. That would be jobs. That would be mental health services. So what is this country doing? What is Illinois doing caging people because they're mentally ill? Something's really wrong with that. I mean, it's like morally wrong and medically wrong. You know, why are we incarcerating people for substance abuse? Why aren't we treating them and supporting them to understand how they can grow to be the best people that they can be without using drugs? You know, what is at the core of their drug use? These are the things that we could get at that really makes our communities truly safe.
And when you just talk about this, the cost of this is, I think, an important part of the conversation. On average, how much does it cost to incarcerate someone in this country?
So on average, it's between $60,000, $75,000 a year for a youth. It can go up to $200,000 per year. So at a New Way of Life, it takes $16,000 for a woman to live in one of our homes for a year. And after that year, she's really standing strong in her community. She's obeying our laws. She's working. She's going to school. She's, you know, creating a business. You know, if I had a few women to create baking business and jewelry making business and different things. But they're a whole different person. After a person is released, after a year of incarceration, they are traumatized and troubled. And that's why there needs to be support for people as they walk out of the prisons back to our community. It can make all the difference in the world in the way in which they develop and become contributing, law-abiding members of our community.
And when we think about that, when you look at the last year and a half in our country, and I'm thinking in particular of changes from President Obama to President Trump. Certainly President Obama had a lot of different reforms that he announced for our criminal justice system. What do you think has changed as far as our federal government's philosophy for the criminal justice system? How much a difference do you think the president makes?
The president makes a huge difference. So we have this growth of detention centers, which is just another form of mass incarceration. We have the dismantling of federal halfway houses, which leaves people falling out of the federal system without supports to be reintegrated back into the community. And that was one of the federal system's kind of a signature pieces that they did for people who were being released from federal prisons, was to give them 9 months of halfway houses before they're actually released, which the state and the county does not do. So it's more dismantling of this social safety net and more building of places for incarceration via the private prison detention centers.
My guest is Susan Burton. Her story is told through a book that came out recently last year called Becoming Miss Burton. She's the founder of A New Way of Life. We're talking about her reentry program. If you would like to join us, our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. Alita just tweeted, thank you for giving Miss Burton's work airtime. As Oprah has pointed out, instead of what's wrong with you, we should be asking what happened to you and what help do you need? Thanks for that comment, Alita. Ms. Burton, do you think that, did anyone ask you, when did someone first ask you that question?
I think the first light of relief that I got was walking through a hall in a prison when I told my teacher there in that prison some of the things that had happened to me as a child and as a young lady. And her response to me was not to worry about passing her class.
And she was a really tough lady.
She was a tough teacher. She was famous for flunking her whole class. And if you flunked this class, you couldn't get released. And it might take you 8 months to come back around to her class. So she was a terror of the yard. And when she said that to me, it's like I got permission to really begin to examine that something really, really went wrong in my life. Something, and that's when I began to sort of look at and tear apart and go back and examine some of my experiences. Because up to that point, you know, you're just navigating trauma. You're just trying to get through one day to the next with as less harm as possible.
And to that point, I wanted to just ask you one more question about your personal story. You always had one person who was trying to encourage you to get out of the life that you were in, and he was your bail bondsman, George. Can you tell me about what he would say to you?
Yeah, he would tell me, you know, you're really, really smart. You could go back to school. You could. He tried to get me to be a one of the people who certifies letters. And he would encourage me and tell me that I was such a good person and that, you know, my life needed to change. And while he was always there encouraging me, he was the one person that, I guess, always stood by me. He's my friend now, and he's retired. He's no longer a bail bondsman. And excuse me. We were talking a couple of weeks ago about the bail industry and how horrendous it is, and how it people are exploited through it. And he was telling me about when that began to take shape and what law enforcement was doing.
Because it wasn't always this way.
It wasn't always this way. The exploitive nature and the high bills and the way people are held now is just out of control.
So in Illinois, there are certain there's some changes that have just taken effect in terms of bail reform in the system, and particularly when it comes to people who can't afford to pay bail and are waiting trial and are sitting in prison. How much do you think it's up to states or municipalities to lead the way in changing the way that we our incarceration system?
Yeah, so it's really up to states, but it's also up to community. It's also up to us to shift our mind to thinking about not punishing people and not retribution, but how do we make everybody whole? What do they need? So what about restorative justice practices instead of punitive responses to social problems like crime? How do we shift to that? How better off would we be as a state? Yes, it is up to states to do this, but it's also up to community. We can't shift all the responsibility to the state. We need to be the example of what we want to see and push our states to actually reflect that.
And so when you say that, what particularly are you thinking about? Are you thinking about the initiatives that you were involved with personally? And I'm thinking about the Ban the Box initiative that originated, I believe, in California.
Yeah, like Ban the Box right here in Champaign on the university application. There's a box that says, have you ever been convicted? Why is that box on the university application? It needs to be taken off. And this community needs to pressure the university to remove that and allow people passage to higher education. That can only help the outcome of any individual. So that's one way there around banning the box on the university application.
And that box is a question about whether or not you've been convicted, whether or not you have a criminal record. How much does that make a difference in someone's life after they come out of prison?
It makes a huge difference because we know from research that the application that's checked with the box is the application that does not get reviewed. It doesn't matter that you went back to school and you have skills in this area and that you have expertise and you have experience. Once you check the box, employers out there know this and people know this, that application usually is passed over unless you have a friend in the place, unless you know someone that knows someone that can help you out there.
And I wonder what you think of some research that I've seen recently about that looks at states that have now initiated these ban the box methods. So they've removed this, but then there's been some research that shows then that wides that creates an even wider effect of discrimination against people who are particularly African American.
Right. There's a study that came out that said a white man with a criminal record is more apt to get the job versus a black man without a criminal record with the same level of skill set. So, you know, we have a big problem, and we have racism is a big problem in America. I've been across the waters to Lisbon, to Portugal, to Norway, to Finland, and I looked at what they do there, and it's so different from what we do here in America, but they have a pretty homogeneous population. Big problem, racism in America.
Well, and I wanted to just ask you about, to that point, you thank Michelle Alexander for her role in your life. And for our audience who don't know her, she's an academic, longstanding work in legal work, as well as academic work in the area of our incarcerated system, the author of The New Jim Crow. How did reading her book change your life?
So let me say, Michelle is my heroine. She's a warrior. She's a strong woman who tells the truth just like it is. And I really admire her. But when I read The New Jim Crow, there was a level of forgiveness. You know, there's layers of things that you do to help yourself, like, you know, like the onion peeling, right? There was a level of forgiveness that I had for myself and for my community members that really went deep, because it explained what had happened in our lives and in our community in a way that the policies, the laws, the manipulation that had been put in place through many administrations, many presidential administrations. And I knew firsthand the impact of that bad public policy, the bad communication strategies that they implemented to tear communities apart and create the us-them type of mentality and attitude. So the level of forgiveness that I felt for myself and for my community really strengthened my resolve to continue to dig in deep and create a way for women who had been criminalized to come back into their communities and pick up their beds and walk.
And so you wrote that in your book, right? That jail didn't help you with your addiction. What helped was having this support system, having education and hard work and dedication and realizing that your life had value. Do you think it's possible to have that in our prison system now?
So I think we have leaned so far toward incarceration and prisons that we've really gotten a warped sort of view of what's necessary. I believe that we should be shifting money out of prisons into communities to make communities stronger, to make people stronger, to create the type of safety that will really have us thrive, have people safe and people not pushed to the edge, people not breaking down mentally because of all the pressures and inability to meet those pressures. I think we spend far too much on police and prisons and not enough investing in schools and communities.
That's Susan Burton. She's the author of Becoming Ms. Burton, founder of A New Way of Life. Thank you for being with me. I appreciate you taking the time.
My pleasure. Thank you for the time spent talking with you today.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Whether you want to talk politics, Drake, or find out how to talk to your parents as an American immigrant, or get NPR's Nina Totenberg to start singing opera, there's one NPR personality who can help. Of course, I'm talking about Sam Sanders. You may know him from the NPR Politics podcast or his own show, It's Been a Minute, which you can catch online or on a couple of public radio stations throughout Illinois, including our home station, WILL. Sam was actually in Chicago last night for a live show of NPR's It's Been a Minute, and he's with me on the line from there now. Hey, Sam, welcome to the 21st.
Thanks for having me. Good to be here.
I would do a hey, y'all, but you're not with your Aunt Betty. It's just you, I assume.
All good. All good.
So, Sam, I think many listeners first got to know you on the NPR Politics podcast, and you were really in the trenches during the presidential election. I imagine the work that you're doing now is kind of a different level of energy. Do you miss that day-to-day politics coverage?
I go back and forth. You know, it's like I'm trying to think of an apt comparison. Some days it feels like I'm in the classroom watching the other classroom kids at recess playing, like on the seesaw, on the slide, on the merry-go-round, and like that's the politics team, and they're just like going. And what we're doing now is a little bit less on the day-to-day, kind of pulled back a bit, but both are exciting. And I think the great thing about the show is that I'm able to bring on members of our politics team all the time to talk about that stuff with me, so I'm not really too far gone from it.
And when you think about elections to cover, 2016 was certainly a unique one. What do you think were your biggest takeaways from covering that election?
I think in ways that we're still acknowledging, the election cycle and its aftermath and the beginnings of the Trump administration have fundamentally changed the way that most of us consume the news. Like fundamentally changed, right? Like a lot of us consume it a lot more. A lot of us let the news make us much more nervous. A lot of folks have totally checked out. A lot of the discussions around issues like politics online have become much nastier. And so like, how do we talk about current events? How do we talk about the news? How do we talk about what's going on in this new environment where everyone's consuming things a bit differently? Like there's this new reality of news consumption. And part of what we're trying to do with the show is speak to that, you know?
Right. And I mean, how do you, that's a really tough thing to do, right? We talk about this every day here on the 21st, and we have a much smaller net than you because we're doing Illinois, although obviously we talk about national politics too. How do you translate that into your, when I'm thinking particularly of your Friday show of It's Been a Minute?
Yeah, I think one of the things that we do every week is like we approach the show inherently with a spirit of optimism, and we aren't afraid to laugh and kind of poke fun at ourselves. So we want people to leave the on the episode feeling as if they've learned something and they feel like they have a grasp on what happened during the week, but they also feel a bit of uplift. Like that is the baseline. Like if we aren't making you smile or laugh or feel something warm in your heart by the end of an episode, we have not done our job. And we were very deliberate about that because we knew that after the election, so much of the country was and still is pissed off. And like,
yeah, people are angry. And you talk about this. People are.
Yeah,
people are angry.
Like, liberals are mad. Conservatives are mad. And I am excited to be a part of a show that tries to just put some happy in the world while we give you your, you know, meat and potatoes and vegetables of news. So,
right,
like,
but to like the meat and potatoes. Are there stories or topics where you just think, I don't want to talk about this? I'm tired of everyone talking about this, or this person's getting too much media coverage and I don't want to do this?
Oh, yeah. The most perfect example was, quote unquote, Comey Week. You know, former FBI Director James Comey released this book, this tell-all, and he literally had the book tour that seems to just not stop. Like he
every GMA, ABC media appearance ever.
It was insane. And so we made a call early on in that week because our, you know, rap episodes come out on Fridays as a podcast and then air on the radio over the weekend. We said on Monday, we're not going to do the Comey thing. We're going to mention it because it happened, but it is not going to be the focus of our show for the week. And, you know, we have the flexibility to do that. And there's so much other news to choose from. You know, I love on the show when we can have weeks where we bring people a topic that is news, but they just haven't been thinking about it. So just a few weeks ago, one of the Castros died in Cuba, and that was a big deal for this nation just to the south of us, and it was an opportunity to have this really interesting and rich talk about like where Cuba goes next, if they go anywhere next. And we could do that in a week where folks were talking about, I don't know, Russia, Russia, Russia. And it feels good when we can get those kind of conversations going.
My guest is Sam Sanders. He's the host of It's Been a Minute. If you've got questions for Sam, by the way, you can tweet us. Our handle's 21STShow. And Sam, to that point, do you think that there's a lot of stories that the national media is missing because it's sort of like this Washington cycle of everything that's coming out of the White House or all of the latest drama or iteration of things that are going on? And that's kind of what grabs the news cycle?
I do think that, like, the vast majority of journalists that I work with in my newsroom and other newsrooms are trying to get it right and trying to do right by our listeners and readers. We have to acknowledge, like, as difficult as it is for news consumers to consume the news these days, it's just as, if not more, difficult for journalists to cover this stuff. Because, like, every day the top is off the fire hydrant and it's just this flood of stuff. I think where me and others in the industry get sidetracked is wanting to tie every story to Donald Trump. You know, there is this new push to cover rural America or pockets of America that are outside of major cities or outside of the Beltway, to cover them more thoughtfully. But it is always through the lens of the election and their thoughts on the president. But, like, there are stories that affect people regardless of their politics, and we have to find ways to get in there, you know? Like, this Donald Trump is such a charismatic figure and just made for news coverage in so many ways. I think it's the onus is on the industry right now, myself included, to make sure that he is not the news peg for everything we do.
What about covering this guy?
That's a real one in your reflection. Without a follow, without a mention, you really piping up on these. You gotta be nice for what to these? I understand. You got 100 bands, you got a baby bands, you got some bad friends. High school pics, you was even bad then. You ain't stressing off no lover in the past tense.
Sam, I had to play that for you because I wanted to get in there and ask, what's the deal with you and Drake?
I just find him annoying. Well, first to back up. So we actually played that song to open up our weekly wrap a few weeks ago.
Yeah, you did a couple
every
weeks
Friday,
ago.
What's that?
Yeah, a couple weeks ago, right?
Yeah, a couple weeks ago. And so every Friday we start the show with a different song. And we started doing that basically because I don't like theme songs and I wanted to mix it up. But now we try to tie every song that we open with to a news hook. And I played that song by Drake. It's called Nice for What. I played it a few weeks ago because – with that song, he became, I'm trying to think of the right way to say it, he became the most number one-iest male artist on Billboard charts for this decade. So he's officially now the biggest male artist in the country of the 20-what-teens, right? Which is crazy because, like, I find him quite annoying. And like, I had to give honor and credit where honor is due because he's done a good job for himself. But, yeah, I don't like him that much. I think he's a little he tries way too hard. He's like that friend in high school who wants to be in all the clubs and be friends with everybody. And I'm like, what is the real Drake? What is the real you?
He's not. Anyway, it's not the Degrassi High Drake. That's not the one.
Well, this is the thing also. Like, he was a child actor from Toronto, and now his public display of self is a lot more tougher than his origins would actually suss out to be.
Last week you were interviewing Asian American actor Jimmy Yang. He's most famous for his role in the HBO hit Silicon Valley. I just want to play a little bit of that conversation.
If you're the one, you carry all the weight.
Exactly. So the problem, it's not enough representation. And hopefully, with Crazy Rich Asian, you get a whole spectrum of Asian. And I felt so good doing that movie because I can just be funny and act a fool.
Yeah.
Because I'm not representing all Asians. I'm just representing one personality.
But you know some people want you to represent all Asians.
Well, they want to blame me for something, you know, okay. Just because...
Do you ever tweet back? Do you ever write back?
I made the mistake of engaging about a week ago.
What did you do?
And it was horrible.
That's Jimmy Yang talking to Sam Sanders, who's on the air with us right now. And, you know, obviously, so I think everyone got a sense of that conversation, but you guys talked about how hard it was, and you were talking about Crazy Rich Asians, which is coming out in a couple of months, and people in the Asian American community are super excited about it. But you also talked about sort of the responsibility that comes with being, you know, if there aren't very many roles for Asian Americans, the responsibility that comes with that. And As I think about that, I'm one of the few Asian American, or if you want to say West Indian or South Asian, you can kind of take your pick of whatever label you want to apply. For me, I'm not that common in the public radio world. Neither are you, being an African American man. Do you feel a certain responsibility that comes with that?
I do. And there are examples of it. Like, you know, every now and then you'll get the letter from a listener that kind of says, well, I would expect that you as a black person would talk about this topic, or I would expect that you would think this way about a certain thing based on who you are. And my pushback generally is I welcome any and all advice about how to be a journalist, but I do not take advice on how to be black. And those are two very different things. And I think for the most part, generally, people are pretty open to me doing my thing and being me, but you do have to remind people. And we're in a really interesting time right now where a lot of what we think people should be and what they should say is based on their identity. And there's a certain kind of thought in the culture that, you know, Asian people should do this and black people should be concerned about this and women are only into these things. And I don't think that's healthy. And so I don't go out of my way to challenge those notions, but I try to make it very clear that I don't have to hold myself to them. But, yeah, I mean, I think we have a lot of flexibility on the show to really kind of push against those boundaries, in part because of the format. Like, so we're doing these Friday wraps of the week of news, but the Tuesday episodes of my show are these long-form interviews where we're talking to everyone from Jimmy O. Yang to Tim Robbins to the author Meg Wolitzer to people like Lena Waithe from Master of None. And we're being able to bring in those really deep conversations with people who in their work and in their lives are pushing those boundaries too.
Yeah, or I should mention Sam Irby, who has been a frequent guest of the 21st, who you talked to last night. So we'll look forward to hearing that episode. Let me just ask you one last question. We just have a couple more minutes here, but how much of this do you think gets exacerbated by social media? And I feel like everyone sort of has this, I think that also kind of ratchets up everything, right? Where everyone's so outraged and there's think pieces, as you tweeted about this. Like, can we just have one day where people aren't outraged by think pieces or op-eds? How do you try to tone that down?
So I take breaks from Twitter throughout the week. So I'll have some nights during the week where I'll say, I'm deleting Twitter from my phone and logging out, and I'm not going to look at Twitter for, 12 hours, 24 hours.
You do that
hours.
A couple times a week?
Oh, yeah, I have to. And I take a lot of Twitter-free weekends because I think, like, and I can't say this enough, like, Twitter is not the real world. Like, it's just not. Like, Twitter is not the real world. Like, that's the baseline. So whenever you see something trending on Twitter, know that it is trending for a fraction of what is 10% of the country. Like, that's like the baseline. So we have to understand that. So that op-ed you're mad about or that tweet that pissed you off, chances are 10 to 12 to 15 times more people didn't even see it because they weren't on Twitter, you know? And I think reminding ourselves of that is really helpful. I also think that, like, part of Twitter is, like, understanding that it is a medium that is kind of meant for quick outrage. Like, that is how you get a following and keep a following and generate, you know, retweets. So even if you like to live in Twitter, you have to understand that part of its arithmetic is meant to be an outrage machine. And just acknowledge that and say that, like, it is an unhealthy level of outrage, but, like, that's what Twitter wants and that's how it works. And we should understand that it is separate and apart. But that said, I still love it for, like, the GIFs and the animal videos and pictures.
The cute stories. Right.
Exactly.
All right. So we've got about a minute left, but I just want to ask you, you end your shows with something called Your Best Thing. What's your best thing for us right now?
Yeah, you know, so the best part of my week, and this is a thing where we have our listeners send us the sound of their voices describing to me the best parts of their week, and we get everything from graduations to new puppies to vacations to weddings, all fun stuff. I would say the best part of my week was getting to talk with Samantha Irby on stage. She just reissued her book, Meaty, this book of essays that's just delightful, and she is so fun and quick and smart and a Chicago hometown hero. And it was an honor and a pleasure to talk with her and really enjoyable to do it in front of a room full of hundreds of fans of the show. And it was a delight. And I, as always, I love to be in Chicago. I like this place so much. So that was for sure the best part of my week.
All right. You can catch It's Been a Minute. You can subscribe to that. And that conversation with Sam Irby that will be coming out soon, I presume. Sam, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much. It was so much fun.
That does it for us today. We're a production of Illinois Public Media. You can always head to our website, 21stshow.org, for more information, our past podcasts, information about this show today. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening. Have a good day.